back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Feeves, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader. And Hal, tell us about our special guest today.
Boy, the challenge in introducing this man that I've known as a dear friend for more than 30 years or somewhere around that mark is I could probably do 20 minutes on just all the things that I know that he's capable of. Peter is an artist. He is a brilliant designer. He's a historian, an entrepreneur. Has worked in the prop business for many, many years, working on films and TV shows that everyone would recognize. Not this particular film, but we're going to get into some of his other work and see those crossovers. So we'll let him fill in some of the rest. But Peter, my old friend, welcome very much to the show. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you very much, Hal.
The pleasure is ours. So, Jim, should I tell you what's going on in Minute 38? Oh, Jim is muted. Those things
happen. We'd love to hear it, Hal.
All right. Jim can tidy this part up.
Yeah.
Peter, I didn't mention this. This is not live. So.
Oh, good. Okay.
We are working with a net, and the net's name is Jim. Okay. In the Brooklyn laboratory, the hum of machinery fades as Dr. Abraham Erskine, his voice tight with anticipation, calls out, "Mr. Stark." The chamber hisses and opens, revealing Steve Rogers, no longer scrawny, but tall, muscular, and transformed. Erskine steps closer, his eyes wide. "Stephen? Stephen?" He helps Rogers out of the machine. Colonel Phillips, stunned, mutters under his breath, "The son of a bitch did it." In the observation gallery, Brandt's assistant Clem leaves a silver case on one of the chairs. Steve, breathing heavily, looks down at his new physique. "I did it," he says, his voice steady with disbelief. Erskine breaks into a relieved grin. "Yeah, yeah, I think we did it." Howard Stark shakes his head in awe. "You actually did it." Peggy Carter approaches, her gaze softening as she takes in Steve's new form. "How do you feel?" she asks. Steve, a faint smile tugging at his lips, replies, "Taller." Peggy holds out her hand, wanting to touch Steve's new muscular chest, but thinks better of it and quickly withdraws. "You look taller," Peggy says, her tone warm, with a hint of amusement. Phillips turns to Senator Brandt, a smile on his face. "How do you like Brooklyn now, Senator?" Brandt, his expression a mix of shock and calculation, nods. "I can think of some folks in Berlin who are about to get very nervous. Congratulations, Doctor." Erskine, his face glowing with pride, responds, "Thank you, sir." Clem, on the stairway, looks up at the observation gallery. And that is Minute 38.
Wow, so much going on, so much yes. Tension, and now the relief of tension, at least portions of it. But we know something's going to come with that fellow Clem.
Right.
Before we dive into Peter and his wonderful career and knowledge, I just want to mention that this minute contains one of the most well-known ad libs in this entire film, which is Haley Atwell reaching out to touch Chris Evans' chest. Apparently, that's not in the script. First time she'd seen him, you know, pumped up like that. And she did that herself. And it's just such a wonderful little moment of just, I can't believe you're real kind of thing. Just beautifully done.
Now, Brian, is there any truth to the rumor that she has done that to you in person on more than one occasion?
Only in my dreams, Hal.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. So Peter, you know, where to start, where to begin? One of the reasons that I thought of you as a guest for this film is because of your experience as a historian and how that's informed your work as a prop maker over the years. You did some work on Jumanji, also directed by Joe Johnston, the same director as Captain America. But before we get to that, one of the things that was top of mind for me was your work on The Man in the High Castle, creating uniforms and insignia and backstory and guidelines for what I would term an alternate, or in that case, sort of a semi-alternate axis. And not in this minute in particular, but we do see some of that in this film as well with Hydra and this sort of you know, SS and a half kind of group. So, Peter, when you are tasked with a project like that, what's your process? How do you start?
Well, I think especially when it comes to a show that's fiction or alternate reality and that sort of thing, and there's an element of something that either needs to be historically accurate or based on something historically accurate, I kind of look at it this way. You know, when your audience, obviously, not everybody will be interested in military decorations or accuracy of uniforms or things like that, but I really think that if the background work is done to make it as authentic as possible, even someone who necessarily isn't an expert on those minor details will kind of have a feeling that it feels right or it looks right, you know, even based on, you know, a minimal understanding of that sort of thing. I think it very much helps to have that foundation.
You know, that resonates very strongly with something we've discussed on the show before. Brian has used the term, you know, verisimilitude more than once to nail that. So, Brian, I don't mean to steal your thunder on this, but I think what you're saying does hit very strongly. There's that that element of it's either accuracy or at a minimum, there's an element of plausibility that needs to take place. And the idea of setting up a set of rules, even if it's fiction, and then operating under those rules and being consistent, I think is very important.
And like you say about the rules, you know, that is a highly important thing, even though that's something that no one actually sees on screen. We developed in, for example, Man in the High Castle, a very detailed, you know, Bible, if you will, about precedent and tradition and that sort of thing that definitely had a great deal of effect on the fictional things we produced.
Right. And for that particular production, I have a copy of that Bible you produced. So I've looked through it. The level of detail is extraordinary, but knowing you as I do, not surprising. But you were doing variations of uniforms and campaign medals, insignia, and even currency. Mm-hmm. Again, to give it that sense of realism throughout. And the work was remarkable.
Thank you. I think a lot depends too. You know, and some people might, aficionados might criticize this or that in a film, you know, if they spot inaccuracies. But one thing I think a lot of people don't realize, a lot of it depends, you know, on the budget, on the time that the production has. So, you know, I think generally speaking, there you have this army of people in the background that is doing amazing things and their very best. And I think in a lot of modern shows, you can really see that. And like I said, if the homework is done, it definitely will have a positive effect on the show. Even though the show might not be entirely about, you know, a medal or a uniform, all these little details have a huge effect.
It occurs to me that one of the challenges of your work is doing all that research, all that development, and then not feeling like you've got to put it all on screen. It's there, it's the background, it creates the world. But for example, I wrote a graphic novel about an old man and an old mad scientist and his giant robot. And I spent an extraordinary amount of time figuring out how that robot worked. And I never once mentioned it in the book, but I knew how that robot worked. And right. And you've just got to do that with 1,000 things. You've got to figure out, you know, how ranks work on the uniforms and how the weapons work and what would be, you know, what Nazis would be carrying around 70 years mm-hmm. after 1940s. And I just think it's an extraordinary amount of work that, like, good special effect doesn't call attention to itself, but it's there and it builds the world.
Right, right. And just like what you guys are doing here with analyzing, you know, these minutes, these sections of a bigger production, you know, if you have a 10-second shot in a film that has a uniform or whatever, what's left behind that is piles of paperwork, meetings, discussions, a whole a world of stuff that's done before that. And you know, sometimes, you know, maybe it can even be a little disheartening when you think, oh my goodness, there's all this work done for such a tiny, tiny little detail. But it's definitely worth it, I think. And you see it on screen, just you know, the quality comes out with everything put together.
It must be, I mean, when the alternate universe idea of Nazis winning World War II. But in this one, we have a excuse me, we have a similar situation in that we have, beside the SS and besides the German army, we have this Hydra group that has to mm-hmm. look like it fits in. We have to kind of they have to kind of shoehorn it in without noticing any of the, you know, the splinters that fall off the sides of it. It has to look like, yeah, this could probably be part of Hitler's military, but it also has to have the Red Skull attitude behind it. And I keep thinking of things in Man of the High Castle. You have that's one of the of several alternate universe looks at what would happen in a post World War II German, like I'm thinking of like SSGB with Len Dayton, that you know, you have to say, well, what happens next, and how is, you know, how does the treasury work, how do you know, fashion and clothing work? And I can imagine that it must be some kind of an 80-20 thing where you do 80% research and then 20% actually putting the medals together and figuring out where they land on the lapels.
Yeah, maybe 90-10. You know?
Okay.
But it's certainly for me, anyways. I love that sort of thing. I mean, history is my is kind of my original passion. So you know, the looking at things in minute detail and research and those sort of things. I mean, that's a great pleasure for me anyway. So I certainly enjoy doing it.
I'm guessing history is your secret sauce, the special thing that makes you different from other people doing the same kind of thing. Like, you know, if you're designing costumes for an army now, you're able to think about, well, what did the Romans do? What did what did all these armies, what did the Visigoths do, and kind of pull these things together. I imagine your head must just be a big funnel that, you know, comes down to create this pure elixir of whatever you're trying to put on screen.
I've never been called funnel headed before.
I can assure
it as a
you
compliment, it's a compliment, please.
Yes.
Brian means well.
I mean, does that sound right? I would imagine hardly a day goes by that you don't think you put your history background to work in this job.
Definitely. And I am rather specialized, so I do get called upon for that sort of thing a fair amount, other than, you know, general prop building. But even with general prop building, you have situations where you need to build something that looks antique or something that looks like it's been lovingly cared for or aged or this sort of thing. So you definitely have to keep those things in mind and think about it, you know, sort of scientifically as you approach it. And at least that's how I look at it.
But I think, Brian, you made an important point there, calling out sort of history and you know, Peter's passion for it and knowledge of it as being a secret sauce. And I think it's worth pointing out that in addition to prop making, I've seen Peter work on restorations of all manner of things, vintage bicycles, old toys. Peter, in your youth, you worked with some well-known folks on a couple of airplanes, even.
The
Messerschmitt, were they both 208s? Were the French built 208s?
Yeah, there's some. So the Nord, I think it's 1101, I think it was called.
Oh, right. Yes.
I could be wrong about that. And then a 108 as well. So the 208s were actually used in the film Patton back in the day.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
yeah. So, I'm not sure what happened to them after. It's been a long time since I was involved. I think they were sold. Right. They probably ended up somewhere.
Were those the ones that were? They were like pretending to be Henkels and in the desert when he was.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
Okay. That, wow. Yeah. Well, they're very exciting. Well,
I know.
So that I bring that up not to just shower more praise on our guest, but just to point out that knowledge of histories of. I see it imbuing everything that Peter does, but also, you know, translates into these real world areas as well. I'd also be remiss if I didn't point out, if there's anybody in our listening audience anywhere in the great province of British Columbia, and you've been around for a while, you might remember the single coolest retail store in human history, and I'm not exaggerating. That was a shop that Peter owned and was running when we met. It was a shop called The Syndicate. And you walked in and half of it was militaria collectibles and uniforms and wonderfully preserved and presented surplus things. And the other half was cool old toys. And we had some great interactions around all that stuff way back when.
Definitely. Very, very good times. Thank you, Al.
Absolutely, indeed. Now, Peter, we mentioned you, you know, you've worked on other properties. I know that that you were around with other productions in Vancouver. So Smallville, as I recall.
Stargate. A little bit on mostly Stargate. Yep.
Stargate was a big one. You even had a walk-on cameo in Stargate.
Yes, it was very brief, but it was certainly a cameo, and I certainly walked on.
Well, and then after you walked off,
I walked straight off.
It was a beautiful bit of symmetry, a staggering performance. But just the image of you in the white lab coat is essentially the mad scientist. And right. We had a recent episode talking about all the fictional labs that we love at movies and TV. And that scene certainly that you did certainly fits in.
That was a great period scene. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And you, you know, you were perfect. I'm surprised you didn't get top billing on that episode.
I've been thinking about the fact I can't believe how much different areas of knowledge you need to bring to your job. And I was thinking in terms of, you know, there's the engineering and there's technology, but there's also, you've got to be very hip to the whole idea of design, the whole philosophy of design. And we've been talking in this Captain America movie a few times about how well we think it's the equipment and the props and everything are designed. You know, we're talking about Airstream trailers and Frigidaire refrigerators and 1940s toasters and you know, early Hewlett Packard oscilloscopes. And they sort of seem to, in this movie, put all that together and come up with a design aesthetic that is totally made up, but fits the time, fits the movie, and really puts you in the story. And so I'm wondering what your thoughts are on design and your background in design and how much of that you pour into your job.
Well, my background was originally graphic design for a brief period of time. And so, you know, I even learned how to use things like ruling pens, which, you know, have gone the way of the dodo bird. But those skills, I think, were a very important foundation. I think when you see a well-done film like the one we're talking about, I think what you want the audience to do is kind of forget about all that foundation because they just want to enjoy it. But I have to tell you, from being involved with it so long, it's a massive army of people that spend huge amounts of time when you're talking about, you know, period items, researching them, tracking them down, finding them. I mean, a lot of this stuff isn't even available in prop rental houses. They have to be purchased and sourced. And then that has to, of course, be brought together authentically to create a look and that design element. Again, it's an enormous amount of work by so many people that, you know, that I mean, I suppose sadly that, you know, aren't necessarily acknowledged, but they're there. So that's kind of a nice feeling for me when I work on a thing like that. I know I have this, like I said, an army of people, this team that really brings everything together so well. And it's so many talented people, really.
And I keep thinking about in production. I mean, I've worked on film productions, and you don't get to do, you don't usually make one piece. You have to build like three of them because two of them might get destroyed while they're acting with them, and things like, you know, hand props and stuff that's going to be, you know, in close up, you have to have what, you know, the hero prop, and so that you're not making one offs. You might have to have your own little assembly line of building. I need a half a dozen Mausers, so please put these together and make sure two of them you can zoom in and see the you know, the serial numbers on the grip. So I keep thinking about how much, as you say, when you see that, you know, if you're watching a movie like this and the credits roll by and it takes 5 or 6 minutes as they're going through gardeners and greensmen and standby painters and things like that, all those people are around to make sure that the thing that you built looks like it should for 10 seconds on film. It's an amazing industry.
Absolutely. And with props especially, but with other departments as well, it's never just one. So one is none. It would be a terrible mistake to even think about having only one, because something gets broken, something gets misplaced, you know, and then you're in huge trouble. So then you have all these technicians and people and actors standing around doing nothing, and that costs an enormous amount of money. So every single prop is always made in duplicate.
Yeah,
sometimes
well,
many, many of them.
Hal and I can attest to a time when there was just one of an item. We went over Joe Johnson's previous film, The Rocketeer, and they had built an entire dirigible that was supposed to burn at the end, and the cameras didn't get it right, and there was too much smoke, and Disney hadn't paid for two, they just paid for one, and they had to pause production while they built another Luxembourg, the sister ship of the Hindenburg.
So a shout out to our dear friend Amy Young, who was up to her eyes in that when all that was going on.
That must have involved a lot of stress, I would assume.
I would
it's
say
not a
so.
Good day on the lot, I think.
Peter, something I'm curious about is, you know, many years ago, probably around the time we met, was the first time that I had gone to a traveling exhibition in San Francisco and saw some deeply beloved Star Wars props in person for the very first time. And you're talking really from the first film primarily. But I remember seeing, you know, the sort of the hero R2-D2, and you get up close to it, and it's you know, it's a near religious experience for somebody like me. It's beautiful, but when you really look at it, it's rough around the edges. And I'm not just talking about the idea of George Lucas and his aesthetic of things being weathered. It's just, it's not as crisp and sharp and things when you see it in person as you do on screen. And at the time, though, obviously that was a non-issue. You know, we weren't shooting things in 4K or 8K and sort of zooming in on every pixel of the film. But fast forwarding, 20 years or so, again, seeing in person your work on Man in the High Castle, to me, that stuff passes muster under a microscope. So have you always worked toward a much higher level of detail than required, or have you noticed in your career, as cameras get better, as arguably people get a little bit more focused, have those standards changed at all in terms of the amount of detail that's required?
I think in some cases the standards have changed a bit, especially as you say, cameras see a lot more and people's screens and things like that. But it really all depends, I think, on the budget and the director and people making the decisions. In the case of the R2 that you saw, although I don't know which one that was, there could have been 20 of those made, and some might have been had more detail than others. But then again, you know, depending on what it was used for, there may not have been the time or the budget to make it absolutely perfect. But hero props, especially, which are the props that are focused on and very important to the show, those are usually done at a very high level. Now, going back quickly to Man in the High Castle, the grown-ups, as we call them, so those are the powers that be, they were very insistent on super high detail. So, for example, we would often picture typed documents, right, on people's desks or people reading them. In those cases, as you know, you can get typewriter fonts and you can print that stuff out. But every single document we used were actually typed out on typewriters because they insisted on that kind of detail. Yeah. Which, you know, you can notice that if you look really close or look on the back of the piece of paper, you see the impression. Plus, the lighting in Man in the High Castle was usually very dim, but they insisted on it. So we did that.
One related thing that occurs to me is I know there's a difference between how a prop or set dressing or a model looks in real life and how it looks in film. Like I know, for example, when people are painting spaceship models or something, they often look very garish in real life, but they look perfect on film. And so you've got to be translating that in your head all the time, is not just how does it look on the desk in front of me, but how's it going to look when they light it and, you know, and film the thing. Am I right?
Absolutely. And even on a smaller level, sometimes something needs a gloss finish. Sometimes it needs a matte finish, depending on the lighting. So there's definitely those things to consider for sure.
I was wondering on the basics of, being in prop design, what does your shop look like? I was thinking, if you're doing wardrobe, if you're doing hand props, you must have like band saws and lathes and sewing machines, or what, how do you handle all of that?
Well, it's my shop is of course top secret. It's kind of like Batcave. Yeah.
It's really more of a lair. I would describe
yes,
it.
Yes,
definitely a lair.
The getting but, moving past the stalactites and the I understand. So,
you definitely have to in props. You have to be familiar with a lot of different tools and mediums and stuff like that. So yes, there's all that stuff from sewing machines to plastic fabrication to woodworking tools. So you really do have to get good at a lot of different kinds of techniques. So definitely a lot of equipment like that is necessary.
I would also think that you could probably have a small army or at least a platoon of trusted technicians that you know and say, hey, I need you to something about how to sew wool jackets. Could you put this together? And you must have quite. I'm going to use an old man term. You must have quite a Rolodex. To look these things up.
I'm just flipping through it like it's going in style. For sure, and there's a lot of subcontractors as well, so that aren't necessarily in the movie business. For example, one thing that's often used, if you'll see a book, for example, an old leather book that someone's leafing through. So we have a company that does book binding. There's very few of those guys around now, but so you kind of gather together a lot of these sort of shops that are on the periphery of the film business that do regular stuff, but you can call upon to do specialized props. I think the book binding example is one important one.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I guess in the movie business, that's an important thing. You don't have to know the guy, but you have to know somebody who knows the guy.
And, absolutely. Yeah.
And, sure. And you're one of those guys who know those guys. Who knows those guys. So.
Yes.
With the giant Rolodex. As
yes.
We say.
Right.
So, Peter, we alluded to it at the beginning, but again, while you were not involved in this particular film, you did work on a Joe Johnston production. Can you tell us a bit about working on Jumanji? What you did there?
That was a long time ago, and I remember we knew each other. I think then, Hal.
We did. Yes.
What year was that? That was probably late 90s or something.
I want to say mid to late 90s, but it was at least. We either knew each other when you were working on it or we met sort of shortly thereafter. Like one thing that stands out is I remember a whole lot of shoe boxes.
You know what? I think I recall something like that. There was a variety of things we did. We did the pith helmets. We did some jewelry. We did the game board or something to do with maybe not the entire game board. I think during that production, I had an eye injury, which I think you remember, Hal. Because,
that's right. I do remember that because we came up to visit you and you were half incapacitated.
Yeah.
I remember reading stories to you. Yes.
So halfway, I had my trusted assistant, Aaron, who I think you remember, Aaron Saul.
Of course.
And he had finished a lot of the work I had started, but it's a little bit of a blur, quite literally.
Quite literally, because it's just one of those jobs you just couldn't see it through. I don't know. I don't know what to say there. I apologize for that one. And do I recall you did something interesting for it? Was a Stephen King? Was it a mini series or a film? Was it Needful Things?
It was Needful Things. So that was a film, and one of the props. So he was the devil, right? Yeah. In there, it was Max von Sydow. If I've pronounced that right. So he had this shop, Needful Things, and it had something to do with, you went in there and you found the thing you've been looking for. So what it was an antique horse race game that I had built. And the horses actually had to go and come up at random. So there was lots of shots of the characters playing this game and, maybe betting for their souls or something like that. I can't quite remember, but that was a pretty significant hero prop.
I appreciate you relating that story. I don't know why I've never drawn the conclusion until now, but I in a way that's how we met. I walked into your shop and you had everything that I needed, and I believe I sold you my soul on the spot. And here we are.
And I'm enjoying that right now.
Well, good, excellent. As long as somebody's getting some use out of it, I clearly have. I've got no use for it.
Well, Peter, thanks so much for being a part of this show. This is exactly why we've been making these podcasts. It's just, so we can talk about things that we normally would never get a chance to talk about. And Hal knows everybody. So so he has the Rolodex that we use most of the time. So.
He treated his soul for it.
Yes. And it was worthwhile. That's for sure. Wow. Thank you for being a part of our show. I'd also like to thank our audience for being a part with us. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America listeners base on Facebook. If you do like the show, please don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at whatever podcast streaming service where you found this particular episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com. And don't forget to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.